is an extremely problematic history from the point of view of religious Jewry. The man, of course, we may even read some sentences. Now, the man is absolutely amazing. Like, he seems to know everything. He seems to know that much that there are moments at which I get this feeling he's using his imagination or he's making it up. There were a whole series of articles that were written in about 1860 by Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch after Heinrich Goetz came out with his first volume of Jewish history. So Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch went to work to dismember Goetz limb from limb. Because Goetz went ahead and took the position, of course, that the Chachmei HaTalmud, the Tanoim and the Amoraim, the halachic positions that they took were directly related to their personality. Now that can be extremely dangerous kind of talk. Because what is necessary in the world of halacha, in the world of Torah, what's necessary is that man should come as close as possible for a human being to absolute objectivity. You have to take the sources and you have to look at them in as objective a manner as one can. And I started rereading it, and he begins with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. I mean, it's something that could have been written today. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is the one who admonishes the Jewish terrorists of Yerushalayim to cede the city to Rome. Give up the struggle. Give the whole city. Not half. The whole city. Give the whole city to Rome. So, Goetz wants to explain that this was something that was a natural bent and inclination of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, because he was a man of peace. A man of peace now. And on what does he base it? Because there's one statement by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai where he says, you know, peace is a good thing. So, of course, Shamshon Raphael Hirsch goes to work on Goetz. I mean, you can find hundreds of Tanoim and Aron that spoke about peace. By the way, all Jews are peace-loving. We all want peace. And anybody who attempts to leave the impression that he's part of the Machaneh HaShalom, the camp of peace, and all the rest of us over here, especially in this hotbed of extremism, the Israel Center, we're all a bunch of warmongers. It's not true. All Jews want peace. The question, of course, is the price. So he wants, Goetz paints a picture of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai in his personality and in his nature. He's a man of peace, and only one man of peace, and the rest of the rabbis most probably are killers. So, of course, Shamshon Raphael Hirsch goes to work. And by the way, there are a lot of areas in which Goetz is very problematic. But what's most interesting, and I don't know how many people know this, the reason why Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch wrote this powerful critique of Goetz is because Goetz, for 3 years, lived in the house of Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch and was his student. And Goetz then left the path of Torah, and here there was this terrible disappointment of Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch that his student goes so far afield. I mean, that's not to, I don't want to diminish the accomplishment. I mean, I say, Goetz's history is fascinating, amazing. But of all things, when he comes to write about Rav Yehuda HaLevi, it's nearly magnificent. It's nearly magnificent. Except, of course, there may be some sentences that I think he makes up. But I'll just give you a few. I'll give you a few examples of what he says. The brilliant luminary of this period and its chief exponent was Abu al-Hassan Yehuda ben Samuel HaLevi ibn HaLevi. Now, he had an Arabic name too, you know, like we have, you know, Harry and Harvey and Max. He was born in Old Castile in 1086. Now, this is one of the things I like about Goetz. have, we'll get to this, we'll see those who write that he was born in 1085, those who say that he was born 1080 approximately. By Gretz, there are no approximations. It's precise. He knows. He writes as though he was there at the birth of Yud-Aleph. But listen to what he writes. In the annals of mankind, his name deserves a separate page with a golden border. How do you like that? To describe him worthily, history would need to borrow from poetry her most glowing colors and her sweetest tones. Yehuda Halevi was one of the chosen to whom the expression, an image of God, may be applied without exaggeration. This is an unbelievable description. He was a perfect poet, a perfect thinker, a worthy son of Judaism, which through his poetry and thought was ennobled and idealized. He brought the nobility of Judaism to the nations of the world. And that beautiful sentence. When Spain shall have discarded its prejudices and shall no longer estimate the greatness of its historical personages by the standards of the church, then Yehuda Halevi will occupy a place of honor in its pantheon. And they'll... It's Gretz that I'm reading. It's unbelievable. The Jewish nation has long since crowned him with the laurel wreath of poetry and recognized the wealth of piety and pure morality that he possessed. His deep moral earnestness was closely united with a cheerful, serene philosophy of life. That means he's earnest, and he's also cheerful, by the way. That you can easily tell from the wealth of poetry that he wrote. He didn't always write serious poetry. He wrote poetry in honor of friends who got married, to simchas, all sorts of things. He wrote about a wide range of topics. The admiration which was showered upon him did not destroy his modesty, and despite his devotion to his friends, he still preserved his own peculiar characteristics and the independence of his youth. His rich store of knowledge clustered about one center, and however great a poet, in the best sense of the word, he may have been, he was keenly conscious of his own feelings, thoughts, and actions. In other words, he's not only the Luftmensch who lives in the world of great ideas, but he also, in his poetry, he expresses his feelings of joy and sorrow and solitude, all sorts of feelings. Yehuda Halevi's biography contains little that is extraordinary. He was born in Christian Spain. He attended the college of Rav Yitzchok Alfasi, the Rif. And he was even there at the time that the Rif passed away, and the Ri Migash, Rav Yosef Migash, is the one who took over. The Rambam also was a Talmud of a student of the Ri Migash. And this was because Castile at the north of Spain was still wanting in Talmudic scholars. All right. We're going to see a little bit more. We'll get some more from Gretz. Only one sentence that I wanted to read now. And Yehuda Halevi not only completely mastered the Hebrew language and the artistic forms of Hebraic poetry, but he also obtained a thorough knowledge of the Talmud, studied the natural sciences, penetrated even to the depths of metaphysics, and was skilled in all branches of learning. He wrote Arabic elegantly and was conversant with the newborn Castilian poetry. He obtained a livelihood as a physician, practicing medicine on his return to his native place. The importance of Yehuda Halevi as a poet lies in those poems that breathe a national religious spirit. I have a feeling Gretz may have been the first one to coin the term, a national religious spirit. But that's why the Kuzri has gone through a revival in the schools of Rav Kook. The text of Jewish knowledge and philosophy and Jewish thought is the Kuzri. The fact is, not known to many, is that the Kuzri was once a major force in the yeshivot litaiyot as well. There is something that I have at home that I'm going to have to look at again as a passable text. There is one text that has the Hebrew and English on sides facing each other. It was a text that selections from the Kuzri that were selected by Rav Chatzkel Sarna, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, the Chevening Yeshiva. And somebody translated them. He excerpted from the Kuzri and took it according to topics. In other words, the Kuzri may have a particular topic that he talks about in essay 1, 2, 3. There are five essays, ma'amarim. There are five ma'amarim that are divided into subheadings, numbers, and so he took together from the various places all of those that dealt with one thought. So the importance of Yehuda Halevi as a poet lies in those poems that breathe a national religious spirit, but in the world, the Lithuanian world, it was most probably the words of the Vilna Gaon that had more impact than anything else. The Vilna Gaon wrote the following: Sefer HaKuzri Hu Kadosh Tahor. The Book of the Kuzri is holy and pure. Ikardei Emunat Yisrael the Torah Tluyim Bo. The fundamental principles of Jewish faith and Torah all hinge on that Sefer. That's quite a statement. That's quite a statement from the Vilna Gaon. And because of that statement from the Vilna Gaon, it became a text that for some reason, I don't know, I think, when I first started learning the Kuzri, I was about 18 or 19. I think I was the only one of the yeshiva that had a copy of the Kuzri. So there must have been a period of time in which it was replaced by other texts. Precisely what takes place now, I really don't know. But that's certainly, if the Vilna Gaon says that Sefer HaKuzri Hu Kadosh V'Tor and Ikarei Emunah, Amunat Yisrael, the Torah Tluyim. What else do we know about the history? I've given you a number of these sheets for you to look at. There's on the first sheet, there's a brief biography of Yehuda Halevi. Was born according to estimates. This at least is an honest approach. In Toledo, in the year 1080, Be'erech, and Od Bialduto, while he was young, he went to the lands of the south, southern Spain, which was Arab Spain. Spain then was divided between in two parts. It was Christian Spain, and there was Spanish and Mohammed Muslim Spain. And of course, there were hundreds of years that there was a struggle. I don't remember, but I think the end of the struggle came with. No, that was not the end of the story. That was the end of Spain. Now, Charlton Heston, whose side was he on? Because he also figures El Cid was led which forces? The forces of Christian. He led the forces of Christian Spain. And finally removed the Moors down to south to Morocco, to south North Africa. He learned in the yeshiva of Rabbi Yitzchak Fassi. He gomarot chachmat harifuah. He finished learning medicine with Parnes Olel b'shuvolo Toledo. When he came back to Toledo, he was a doctor. Most of the gedolei Yisrael at the time worked in the field of medicine. There he married his wife, and then afterwards he went to the Arabic part of Spain, to Cordova, and in the year 1140, he left everything. 1140 is when he is going to pick himself up and finally attempt to realize his life's dream, because his life's dream was to be in Eretz Yisrael. And therefore his great poetry, really reflects his undying love for Eretz Yisrael and for Tzion, and we're going to see a number of his poems. He left his family, his beloved family, his students, his friends, those who respected him, and he went to Eretz HaKadoshah. He stayed a certain amount of time in Egypt, in Alexandria, Cairo, and Demiata, and he was accepted with a great deal of hitlahavut. He was world known in the Jewish world. by all sorts of friends who wanted to. They had him stopped in Cairo for a number of months, in Alexandria, and then he insisted he must go on to Eretz Yisrael. Of course, when he comes to Eretz Yisrael from that point on and further, legend and tradition takes over, but we don't have any historic facts that we can talk about. Of course, the great story that we all heard, most probably still as of children, I remember my father telling me by the Shabbos table about the Yehuda HaLevi, who, as he enters Yerushalayim, prostrates himself on the ground and kisses the earth, and an Arab horseman rides over him and crushes him to death at the gates of Yerushalayim. That's what tradition tells us. But we don't know where he's buried. We have absolutely no idea. But that's tradition. That's tradition. I remember every time my father told me the story, I'd get so choked up. And we're going to see, of course, for us it's going to be important to see those parts, those sections in the Kuzri which talk of his profound love for Eretz Yisrael. And maybe I'll put it in early in the course so that we'll get a feeling for the national religious nature of the Kuzri. But of course I have two poems here, we'll take a look at them quickly. The first one is, of course, the most famous one of all. Who didn't learn that when they were little children? And here, at least, you have the whole poem. Livi b'mizrach, my heart is in the east, v'nochi b'self marav, and I'm at the very end of the west. Eich etamat asher ochal ve'eich yedav. How can I taste that which I eat? How can it be sweet to me? He leaves the impression that as long as he's separated from Eretz Yisrael, there can't really be any joy in life. How can I taste that which I eat? How can it be sweet? As long as I'm still here, how am I going to repay? How am I going to fulfill the promises and the vows that I made? That should bring back memories of Kol Nidre. Tzion bechevel adom vani bechevel arav, while Tzion is in the hands of Edom. Chevel means bound and tied by Edom. Edom is Rome. Vani bechevel arav, and I have the ropes of Arabia around me. Yekal beinai, in my eyes it is easy. Azov kol tuv sforad, I can leave all of the good of Spain. As it is precious to me, so that I should see with my eyes the dust of the holy place that is destroyed. Easy for me. I would rather be there amidst the ruins of Tzion and Yerushalayim, and he's ready to give up all of the good and the wealth of Spain. Then the other poem is Yefeinof. Mesos Tevel, Yefeinof, Mesos Tevel. We say that that comes from Tehillim. That's the description of Yerushalayim. Yefeinof, the beautiful scenery. Mesos Tevel, the joy of the whole earth. Kiryah, it is the metropolis. Lemelech Rav, to the great king. Loch Nichsefon Nafshi, to you my heart longs, my soul longs. Mipartei Marav, from the very ends of the west. Hamon rachamai nichmar ki ezkiro kedem. All of the mercy and pity within me becomes warmed when I remember kedem kvodeich asher gala, your honor. You once had the great glory that you once had, that is exiled, v'noveich, and your dwelling place asher chorav, that is destroyed. Oyumi etneni al kamfi nishar. You hear a poet who's dreaming, if only I could get on the wings of eagles. Umi itneini al kamfin yishorim, ad araveh bidimati afareich, until I will sate with my tears your the dust of Eretz Yisrael of Yerushalayim. V'it arav, and it will mix with the dust. Drashtich, I will seek you. V'imalkech einbach, if even though your king is not there, vim b'mekom tzori giladeich, and in place tzori giladeich, this is a pasuk from Hosea. Gilad is Ever Yadin. Tzori giladeich was the balm or the healing powers of Gilad. If you don't have that, and instead, you know what you have in Eretz Yisrael? Nachosh, Sorof, Vegam Akrav. It's a place of snakes and Akrav, scorpions. Despite the fact that it's a desolate place in ruins. Halo et avonayach achonein, I will grace your stones, ve'eshokem, and I will kiss them. Ve'tamriv govayach, and the taste of your clumps of earth, lefi, to my mouth, midvash ye'erav, will be even sweeter than honey. If you read the Jerusalem Post this past Friday, they had an article about Mark Twain's visit to Eretz Yisrael. Where was it? In 1870, something like that, that he described in his Innocence Abroad. I always say that his description of Eretz Yisrael is extremely important. He describes a country that's dead, absolutely dead, dry. I always say, don't read Mark Twain's description of Eretz Yisrael unless you have a cold big bottle of May Aden next to you. Because you're going to get so thirsty just reading about how dead and dry and desolate and arid the land is. And That's what I mean. I believe Mark Twain, but here we have a verbal picture of what Eretz Yisrael is, and then we see the reality of Eretz Yisrael. If Mark Twain would have come back 60 years later, he wouldn't believe his own eyes. And we've talked about that. That's the great Gemara that says, "Ein l'chokets megula mizeh." There is no greater revealed end of days than when Eretz Yisrael begins to give out fruit that can sustain a population. 60 years after Mark Twain's visit, there were all sorts of things were growing in Eretz Yisrael because the land knows when Klal Yisrael is on the way back home. It's unbelievable. That, the Gemara says, is the revealed end of days when Eretz Yisrael gives out its produce. And then, oh, come on. I've quoted this pasuk. You all know the pasuk. Va'atem hore Yisrael, you mountains of Israel, pasuk in Yecheskel, amtechem titenu, give out your branches, uperichem tisu, and carry your fruits, la'ami Yisrael, for my people Israel, ki kervu lavo, because the time of their return is coming close. Eretz Yisrael knows the land. It's a land that lives and knows that Klal Yisrael is on the way back home, and it responds to the ministrations of Yiddish Hentalach. But for 1900 years, the Ramban, who saw Eretz Yisrael about 50, 60 years after Rabbi Yehuda Levi, the Ramban is the one who describes it, that the place, the holier the place is, the greater is the desolation and destruction. For 1900 years, Eretz Yisrael is desolate. And here we're living, what are you talking about? I always say every time you eat a tomato, every time you eat a fruit or a vegetable, you have to know that this is Matnas Hashem. It's God's gift. It's God's gift. Here he's talking, his description of Eretz Yisrael is what it was. It was desolate. Charev, Nochosh, Sorof, Akrav. Twain describes that the wind just blows dust. There's nothing to stop the dust from swirling around. Wherever he went, it was all dust. It was all dry. Nothing was dead. Nothing was living. All right. Now we'll give you the outline of the text. The text is most probably one of the first, if not the first, that was written in the form of a dialogue. Since Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's Kuzri, there are all sorts of books that have been written as dialogue between Rebbe and Talmud, father and son, the 19 letters of Ben Uziel by Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch is also a dialogue, all sorts of dialogue. His dialogue was based on historic fact. He says that some 400 years before his time, there was a people living in Central Asia by the name of the Khazars. And the king of the Khazars was a pious and a sincere and an earnest individual. And he starts having dreams. And in his dreams he's told, Kavanotecha ritzuyot, your intentions are good, avol masecha einon ritzuyot, but your deeds are unacceptable. Which means that he there's something he's not doing right, or there's something he's not doing, and in his great piety, he searches and prays and hunts until he decides that, because he keeps getting the dream. Dream keeps being repeated. Your intentions are good, but your deeds are not. So then he decides that he's going to speak to a philosopher. And at the very outset he says he doesn't plan on speaking to a Jew because they're a small people, they're despised. And by virtue of the fact that they are despised in the world, there's really nobody to talk to there. It's not even worth my time. By the way, the subtitle of the Sefer HaKuzri, when it was written by Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, was a defense of the despised religion. That was the title, a defense of the despised religion. And we'll see how he says at the very beginning who he is addressing this to and what was the need for his Sefer. Klal Yisrael and Torah Yisrael were under attack. Nothing, of course, has changed in, 900 years since Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. Anyway, in the Sefer, the king of the Khazars calls a philosopher, he talks with the philosopher, and the philosopher leaves him completely cold, has accomplished nothing. He then speaks to a Christian, and he has serious questions about Christianity that simply it doesn't make sense. There's something missing. He speaks to a Muslim and he's left absolutely unconvinced. And we'll see what the arguments are. And then with great reluctance, says, I had told myself I'm not going to speak to a Jew, but I see that I don't have much choice, so I'm going to speak to a Jew. And he calls a rabbi, and the rabbi is the Chaver. He's called the Chaver, the Talmud Chacham. And then begins this great dialogue until the end of the Sefer. Little by little, the Chaver begins to teach him the fundamental principles of all of Yahadut. And the end of the story was that he and his people, ultimately all converted to Judaism. I don't know what happened to their traces. There was some book that was written some years ago that wanted to say that there are no real Jews. The only ones that extend today are... from the Khazars, don't believe a word. Don't believe a word. We have Kohanim and Levim that go back long before the Khazars. We're the children of Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Where the Khazars are, may very well be that they simply were subsumed within the Jewish people. Right now, I'm not going to deal with. I just want you to hold on to this. The third page, which is a bit of a history. You can read that, but we may go through. So that you should know the extent, and I'm only touching on one of the kinot of Tisha B'Av, which was written by Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, and here you see what I've done for you. I give you the Hebrew and the English side by side, and maybe we will do a little reading of it, but we're not going to do that today. This is Tzian Alo Tishali, is one of the powerful kinot of Tisha B'Av, written by Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. And there it says at the top, born in 1080, around 1080, and died in 1145. All right. Since you don't have texts, you know what you're going to do right now? You're just going to sit back and you're going to relax. And I'm going to do a little reading for you and translating. And by next week, we will know already what text I'm going to require of you. But we didn't know. I think we decided the English one, right? You're going to use the English? Okay, I'm sorry. You're going to use the English text, and I may, where there are particularly beautiful segments, I'm just going to want you to have the Hebrew, so that'll be my problem. Okay. Just sit back and... Now relax. Yes. Oh, the English one? From Isaac Husik's book, which is the story of medieval philosophy. I think that's the text. All right, let's sit back. Okay? Sha'ol Sha'oluni, he says. I'm reading the opening, the introduction. I was asked, La'tanot v'la'tshuvot asheriti, what kind of claims and answers do I have? Neged ta'anoteim shalachokim al dotenu, against those who have all sorts of complaints against our Torah and our religion. And he lists the long list of those who find fault with Judaism. Mibein hanim shachim achara philosophia, those who follow the philosophers. Ubein ma'aminei datot acherot, and amongst those who believe in other religions. Umibein haminim mibnei Yisrael, and from the non-believers within our midst. It was always a problem. We always had a problem with our own chevre in our midst. And by the way, of course, it was because of them that Rabbi Gamliel decided that we have to add a 19th bracha to Shmona Esrei, V'lamalshinim al tehi tikva v'chol haminim kirega yovedu. We're talking about something that was composed with great pain at a time that Jews were suffering terribly from the Christian communities that grew out of our midst. We were suffering more from Jews from within than we suffered from those from without. As we have talked already in the past about the fact that we're suffering today from our own people, and it was always so. But for that suffering, Rabbi Gamliel was the one who asked Shmuel HaKatan to compose that bracha, and it became the 19th bracha. And I always say that I believe that even though there are 19 brachas in Shmon Esrei, we still call it Shmon Esrei. We still call it 18. Why don't we call it 19? Because we're not too proud of that bracha. We wanted in Shmon Esrei. We needed desperately in Shmon Esrei. But we don't want it to sort of, there's a form of concealment, something camouflaging and hovering over that 19th bracha. We put it in the middle over there, and we're very unhappy that we reached a point in history where it was necessary to do that. Darshanim have said over the years, why was it Shmuel HaKatan? One of the great Tanoim was Shmuel, the small one. Why was he the one that composed, or why was he asked to compose this bracha? So you should know there's one statement of Shmuel HaKatan, there's one statement of his in Pirkei Avot. Shmuel HaKatan is the one who says, "Binefol oyivecha al tismach," when your enemy falls, don't be happy. You needed somebody who was going to write this bracha with tears and with a broken heart. Our rabbis would not permit into the Shmon Esrei a bracha that was written dripping with absolute venom and hatred against the enemies of Israel. That doesn't belong in the Shmon Esrei. But when you have somebody whose whole character and personality, and I don't mean it Gretz-like, "Binefol oyivecha al tismach," for a man to have made that sort of his motto, he must have been living at a time at which there were enemies of Israel. And if anything, he was the one who attempted to blunt their blows. Yes, Malka? Atem omrim shicha. Malka, I have people in different places in the world that there are people who listen to my tapes. One of them is my brother-in-law, Bela's brother. He once asked me, "Who's Malka?" You should know, Malka, you're known worldwide. Mendel once asked me, "Who's Malka?" Anyway, so Rav Yehuda Halevi says that he's writing a book to answer the onslaught and the attack of all of those against us. V'nizkarti, and I remembered what I had heard a long time ago, Ta'anot Shetoran Achaver, that the Talmud Chacham who met with the king of the Khazars, Lishnei Ka'arba Meyot Shana, some 400 years earlier. That comes about the 6th or 7th century. In the presence of the king of the Khazars, Ta'anot, and what was said by the Chaver, the Talmud Chacham, is that which Asher al pi and kibra melech, the king accepted that Hayehudim, the religion of Jews, Kemosha Adovam the Fursim, as is well known, and as is mentioned in the history books of the time. Melech Zeh, Mesupar Sham, it tells us about that king. Nishna alav chalom echad pamim rabot, it was a dream, became recurrent and incessant time and time again. Bechalomo in his dream, v'inei malach, behold, there's an angel speaking to him and says to him, your intentions are good in the eyes of God, but your deeds are not. He was a frum kuzri. He did all of the mitzvahs of their religion, which was a pagan and a heathen religion. He himself served in the temple of the Khazars. And he brought sacrifices, and he did it with great kavana. He was a real frumer guy. And he keeps having this dream that his intentions are good, but his deeds are not. And the more intense he became in his kuzri frumkeit, the more the dream becomes not only incessant, but insistent, because he's gone in the wrong direction. So he keeps having the dream until he realizes that he must put a stop to it and go out and study all over again and find out what is it that God wants of him. And Rav Yehuda Halevi says that many of the things that I heard in the name of the Chaver, and I don't really think he heard anything, he's making it all up. Now this is the fiction part. I liked what that Talmud Chacham said to the king of the Khazars, and I decided that I'm going to record it and write it down. It's all Rav Yehuda Halevi's it's all his creation. But he leaves the impression as though this is the conversation that took place between the king of the Khazars. All right. Aleph. The first, he calls a philosopher. You don't have this. This is, you're just going to sit and listen with rapt attention to me, and I'll try and make it as exciting as I can. The philosopher says that before God, there's no will, there's no hatred, there are no feelings, because God is really miromam. Now, I want the camera to see you, Jonathan. Come here. Yeah. This is Jonathan. And the philosopher says, the classic approach of philosophy is the chief executive officer of a corporation who has outlived his usefulness. What do you do with a CEO? You know what you do? You kick him upstairs. You kick him upstairs means that on the 54th floor, you make an office for him that the world never saw. You give him another few stock options over there. You keep him quiet because he's just going to live happily ever after. But you get him out of the scene of activity. Because the younger people, they're the ones that are taking over. So you kick the CEO upstairs. That's precisely what the philosophers did. God is so big. He's so great. He doesn't deal with this world. What are you talking about? There's no such thing as will, or that he wants you to do this, or he wants you to do that. And Shaharei HaKavona, they say, what do you mean God wants something from this world? if God wants something from this world, that means He's lacking in something. Now, God is so perfect that He's lacking nothing. So you can't say that there's something He wants. He wants me to do something? He wants us to perform mitzvahs? What does He need it for? And if you tell me that He needs it for something, that means He's lacking something. If He's lacking something, then He's not perfect perfection. You know, you make it all sound very, very logical. He simply is not involved. And furthermore, you're going to tell me that He knows what takes place every minute. That means God is overwhelmed, so to speak, with details. Now, God can't be involved in details because His knowledge is perfect. And if you tell me that He's involved in details, those are things that change from minute to minute. He has to wait for the next minute and he gets the next bit of information. He never has a clear, complete picture in front of him. They're not ready to say that there's a God like this. God is me'al yediata pratim. He stands higher than the knowledge of simple details. Ki ha'pratim mishtanim mirega lerega, because details change from minute to minute, and God's knowledge is not given to change. It's absolute perfection. Furthermore, the philosophers believe that there was no act of creation of man. Man was always here. The Hebrew term for this is kadmut ha'olam. The world was always here. It goes all the way back. We believe, of course, in chidush ha'olam, that the world was brought into being anew by the Rebbeinu Shlomo. The philosophers go on to say, u'me'olam lo bara aka adam. God never created man. Ki ha'olam kadmon, the world was always here. And from since time immemorial, man has been born from man, and every man carries the genes and the nature and personality of his parents and his other those around him. There are all sorts of influences on the human being that are a result of climate, the society within which he lives, diet, water. All of these factors impact on the human being, and they create his personality, and therefore there can be differences between people. Latins are hot-blooded, French, I don't know what they are. You know, there are all sorts of different things you can say about different people because they come from different parts of the world. Now, is there a purpose to this man? What's man supposed to do as long as he's on the face of this earth? So he says that man's responsibility is to make of himself the best and the most moral that he can be. All of the people who live on the face of this earth, there are causes that bring him to fulfillment and completion, to make him a perfect human being. Misha kodmulo kol sibotov elu, anybody who all of these reasons, all of them have been fulfilled, naaseh shalom, becomes a perfect human being. And somebody who's not gone through that entire process is somebody who remains lacking. Ben Kush l'mashal, I have to read it, he says, a son of Kush, somebody who comes from Kush, for example, lo hispigalo hachanotala tivit, all of the natural preparation that was necessary for him is not complete. I imagine he's talking about the black man. Yonsios, in my youth, used to be known as a Negro. He's not a fully developed human being. We understand that there would be burning kuzris. He looks like a human being and he speaks like a human being, but with absolutely all of the faults, there's something lacking. Who is the perfect human being? The perfect human being is the philosopher. The philosopher has reached the apex, the apotheosis. Wouldn't it be easier to speak in Hebrew? Easier words. Who has reached the very height of perfection, and in terms of intellect, deed, morality, ethics, there's absolutely nothing missing from his completion and fulfillment. But don't think that a philosopher is born a philosopher, but a philosopher has to put in effort and work until he reaches that point. It's going to be important to know this in terms of what Rav Yehuda Halevi is going to say as we continue on. I'm not going to get to it now. He's going to make the point that there was only one people in history that had prophets. Only one people in history about which we have books of prophecy. And the prophet stands far, far higher than the philosopher. The philosopher will never, ever achieve prophecy. He's also going to make a very fascinating comment, and by the way, this also comes later on. He says that the philosophers came from Yefet. There was three children, Shem, Cham, and Yafet. Klal Yisrael comes from Shem. The philosophers came from Yefet, the Greek philosophers. Did it ever occur to you? He said it 900 years ago. But it's very fascinating. He says, after the generation of the great philosophers, Greece never, never accomplished anything intellectual. Except for Anthony Quinn. There was mamish. It's a fascinating idea, and the Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says the difference between Klal Yisrael, who come from Shem, and the Greeks who come from Yefet, is Shem had a Mesorah and a Kabbalah. By Shem, there was the historic Mesorah of Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, David, Shlomo. There was divine wisdom that was transmitted from generation to generation. And he says it's not Greece's fault that they never achieved prophecy or greatness. What's truly unusual about Greece is that period of the philosophers. It's a fascinating period. Great minds. We're talking about Plato, Aristotle, Socrates. We're talking about great, great minds. But in the longer view of history, it was just a relatively brief period in time, but wisdom didn't remain with them. I'm sure if Rav Yehuda Halevi would be writing today, he would say, but by Klal Yisrael, wisdom, brilliance, and genius has remained ad hayom hazeh. I mean, it's not a matter of patting ourselves on the back, but the fact is that we're the smallest people on the face of this earth. And we are also, I think they say that we're pretty bright. We're pretty bright. We have a larger number of Nobel Prize winners than anybody else. We have Shimon Peres. We've got them. I mean, we are a very brilliant people. Anybody who's listening to this, that was a joke. He says, for the Greeks, there was just one particular moment in time at which there was greatness, and after that it was gone. Never, ever. Greece never recovered. Never, ever came back to what it was in the times. I mean, the big question is, where did that wisdom come from? Not so simple to answer that question. Where did it go? So you know where it went? I mean, we picked it up. And by the way, that's the... we may yet come to a point where we will have to describe the difference between the Rambam, Maimonides, and Rav Yehuda Halevi. And I saw one beautiful description, because Rav Yehuda Halevi, the Rambam makes great use of Aristotle, Aristotelian philosophy. He will be mentioned by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, but Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is completely unique, natural, organic Judaism. Organic. It's not influenced by philosophy. Even though there are those who say that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and there are places where you can see you can see it, that he knew Greek philosophy. He was a genius in Greek philosophy. But he came up with an original approach to Judaism that is pure, pristine, natural Judaism. Somebody once said that the Rambam, who is the one who wants to bring Torah closer to the philosophical and intellectual approaches of the philosophers. And Yehuda HaLevi is the one who takes the philosophers and intellect and brings them closer to Torah. The dominant factor by Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is Torah. And everything that he's going to say derives and flows directly from Torah. There are no outside influences on the in Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. There were other great thinkers in Judaism where you could see clearly that there was even Rav Kook was brilliant in philosophy. He had mastered a great deal of the philosophical thing, but he was able to create a pure ideology and philosophy of Torah. That's what we're going to see in Rav Yehuda HaLevi. All right, just a few more minutes with the philosopher, and we'll close with that. And so he says to the king, the philosopher says to the king, "Bakesh l'cho yediyat dvarim alam itatam, go seek truth. But you should know one thing. There is absolutely no prescribed form of conduct. There are no mitzvahs you have to do. Just seek truth. Seek intellectual knowledge. Conduct yourself properly. Be an ethical and moral individual. That's what you should do. But there's nothing that you have to do. There are no do's and don'ts in the world of the philosopher. Just let your heart lead you to do the right thing. Let your mind become filled with knowledge." Needless to say, the king is not impressed at all by the words of the philosopher. I'm going to give you some homework, certain things to read when you have your text. Because the dream tells him precisely the opposite. The dream is telling him that your intentions are good, your heart is in the right place, your mind is in the right place. The only thing that you're lacking, is correct deeds, which means the message that's being sent to him from heaven is that there are deeds. God wants you to do something. And this doesn't exist in the world of the philosopher. In the world of the philosopher, if God does exist, he certainly doesn't make himself felt over here. There is no hashgacha protest, there's no divine providence, there's no reward and punishment. There are no mitzvot ma'asiyot, there are no mitzvot to be done, or things to avoid and not to do. It's a whole different world, and this is a world that, both by virtue of his pagan upbringing, and by the incessant and recurrent dreams that he's having, there is no place for the philosopher. Because this much the king understands. There is a God who knows, there's a God who cares, there's a God who's involved in the life of men. He's not the CEO that's been kicked upstairs to the 54th floor. He is somebody who's intimately involved with all of his creatures on the face of this earth, and there's something that he wants from them. And this he doesn't find by the philosopher. What will be fascinating is, what does he hear from the Christian, and what does he hear from the Muslim? Okay. Hemshech Yavol.